Hey, Pistol.
Hey, Dagger.
You know what time it is?
Yeah, it's gotta be about 3 o'clock.
No, dumbass. It's time for the Pistol and Dagger Society, presented by Meltdown Comics. We hit the LA streets to fill the kitchen table seats. Our guests live really cool lives. And we ask a bunch of questions about it the entire time.
Me? I thought you were doing it.
No, you have to start this one. I'll introduce our guest when the time comes.
And welcome to the Pistol and Dagger Society presented by Meltdown Comics. My name is Sadie. And over here we have Ken Jack Hello. Dempsey.
Ken Jack Dempsey.
You know.
I'm the Pistol of Pistol and Dagger.
One.
You're the Dagger.
Yes.
Pistol and Dagger. What do we decide that Adam is?
And?
The hilt?
I'm and. I'm the society.
No, he's and.
Society.
Pistol
we've,
dagger
we've
society.
Already got a we've got a throwing star. We've got a crossbow. We have a
hand grenade.
I like throwing stars.
You can't be throwing
stars. I was always... Why can't be?
Because we have a
we have
a throwing
one.
Star.
Oh. Anyways, my name's Adam. Hi, guys. Wednesday's Finest, a.k.a., right?
Yeah, that's
Oh,
what
this should
are.
Be the episode where we know what that is.
Yeah, but... You don't.
And I can't. I'll tell you why. That this we
tell
don't
me
have
why.
Time with it. Because sitting here today with us is somebody that I have known since I was a little child, since I was 10 years old. I had the incredible pleasure of watching him perform on stage. Was it the Schubert Theater in Chicago you guys played?
Yes, that time that you saw. Yeah,
Mitch Weissman, who back in the day, my older brother and I were convinced not only that John Lennon was still alive. Well, no, John Lennon was still alive when you were
yes,
there.
Yes, he was, yeah.
But that you were Paul McCartney. And you were touring with Beatlemania, the original Broadway cast of Beatlemania, back when we saw you.
That's right.
And what were you guys doing in Chicago? Were you just touring throughout the United States? Or were
yeah, the tour that you saw was our second run through Chicago. We had done the Blackstone Theater.
That's where I saw you, was the Blackstone.
Yeah, so you're even younger than you remember. So Blackstone was the first tour.
Was that 1978?
70. It was right after the Chicago riots. So whenever that was,
did we meet the Beatles there? Is that why you guys came?
I don't remember why we came. We stayed at the really nice hotel, and then we moved to apartments up on Delaware Place and stuff like that.
Now that I'm older, one of the questions I do want to ask you about it was is what was it like being in a hotel in a city as part of that cast? I never got a chance to ask you that when I was younger. But before we do that,
yes.
You, after we saw Beatlemania, which to two Beatle freaks like me and my brother that knew every line in the movie Help and knew every scene in Hard Day's Night and watched everything we could get our hands on back in the day, you guys were more the Beatles to us than the Beatles. And I think, can you explain a little bit about what Beatlemania was and why that we would actually have felt that way?
Well, by the time we did the show, I mean, the Beatles were around for almost like 10 years already anyway, or about maybe 7 or 8. But as a group... So the idea came about by the producers, Steve Lieber and David Krebs, to put on a show showing how, actually, I'm the one that came up with the phrase, I'm actually the person who came up with the phrase, rockumentary, about how the effects of the Beatles, how the effects of the 60s and the turmoil in the United States affected the Beatles and their music and vice versa. So they went and looked at all the playlists that were being played on the radio stations in New York. They picked all these songs out. And they were going to have a show that had a lot of Beatle footage and us fronting it, or a show about what I just said, about the events of the 60s and stuff like that. And the lawyers said, go with that one. And we did, and became much more of a cultural phenomenon.
Well, I think part of, I don't know, do you know what Beatlemania is? Do you remember that? Do you remember the Broadway show?
I don't remember it, but I assume, and what I've read is that it was, in fact, a Broadway show where they had... members of the cast playing members of the Beatles and
playing every instrument, singing every song
right.
for 3 hours on stage. And that was something just real quick that Mitch and I have talked about before is that what made that such a better Beatles experience for us as huge fans was the Beatles would go and record a couple of songs in a couple of weeks. And they would, if they were to perform a show live, like at Shea Stadium, they were only playing like 7 or 8 songs. Right. But you guys were going from the very early days.
Yeah. We went through their whole careers. And the thing that was interesting was that up until that point, 1976, when we rehearsed, 77, when we opened, no one had seen that music live and the technology didn't exist in it. And no one had tried to do the Beatles stuff that way. There were bands that played the band Rain, not the same version that's now, but guys, predecessors before that were doing this scaled down versions. There were no keyboards and that stuff. So we had offstage musicians, like about five or six. Mm. We had a mellotron backstage, the Moog. We had all this and horns and strings and stuff and augmented. But we played live, and it just seemed, when you sat in the audience, that it could not be real because the sound system was great. It was a Broadway system, surround sound with speakers in the back, slightly delayed. I remember for the first time ever coming out here in 78 when we moved here and watching David Leon sing Come Together. And you'd swear he was, the effects, his voice was ahead or behind the effects that you heard. So it seemed like it was recorded. A lot of reviewers used to think we were playing the tapes. Mm. But as one guy said, how can they do the songs at 2 minutes and 30 seconds every night?
Right. Like,
because that's how long the song is. You know, so.
Yeah.
Were you able to ever ad-lib at all, or was it just, was it a tight script? It seemed like you guys were just friends on stage.
It was, yeah. Basically, we had a lot more dialogue in the beginning until the legal aspect of saying things at the beat. We called ourselves, my friend here, or the bass player is going to play this. We didn't call each other.
You didn't call each other?
Name, John Paul, George, or Ringo. Okay.
How much dialogue was there outside of, intros, you know, concert
outros,
talk?
Not much.
Concert talk.
We
was
came
it
up
an
with
acting
some,
job or musician job?
It originally was an acting musician job or a musician acting job, and then they took all the acting out for legal purposes. So we'd sit little speeches. We would say clips that came. On the cast album, you hear me do the beginning to Martha, my dear, and Joey yells, put that dog on a leash, you know, things. So we do little tiny ad-libs. You couldn't say much.
It was like a 3-hour concert.
It was about, probably 2.5 if you had the intermission in there. But the thing we did, the ad-lib stuff was we would do Nowhere Man and then throw in the Andrew Burkitt sing solo and then go back to Nowhere Man, which is basically very similar. So people in the audience go, hey, I heard that. Or you're doing little things, you're sticking a note here or something like that. And amazing, over the years, people, I heard that, you're doing this song in the middle of that song. Going, okay, I guess people are paying attention. But
I've seen today when you've been playing, because you're still out doing Beatles stuff. I've seen fans that are definitely groupies. Did you have groupies that were coming every night to your shows? And
a lot of them weren't groupies, they were just fanatics that would come and pay.
So they came with screaming women too.
Yeah, they came, exactly. Yeah, or they left and their screaming women stayed behind.
All right.
That's what that, but it was a fun time. I was married at the time, so the groupies went that way. So
he's pointing to the left, yeah. By the way.
Exactly.
In radio
exit
land.
Stage exactly. Left.
Yeah. Okay. Well, hold on,
real quick. I just have to ask. You're not from England.
No, I'm from New York.
And
Long Island.
Would
Jewish
you use boy. A an English accent?
Well, we did because occasionally, you know, we'd speak. You know, my friend here is going to come down. I'd just like to say thank you very much for coming. You're a lovely audience. We hope you have a really good time, you know, things like that.
So, okay, well, that's pretty good. I believe you.
I want to say that before, I want to kind of go back to how it all started, but if for you two, for Sadie and for Adam, Warner Brothers made a movie of it called Beatlemania that was in theaters.
Right? It's actually American Cinema. Yeah, it was in theaters for a while.
And you can still, I've seen it online, so you can actually watch the entire thing.
Movie, yeah.
And it's pretty amazing because it was very documentary, too. There was tons of footage.
Rockumentary, please.
Rockumentary, sorry.
Give him his credit.
It's fine.
Okay, so how did this all happen? So you were living in New York. You were young when you got this, right?
Yeah, I was living in New York. Was I still in Long Island or was I in Forest Hills? The same place.
Were you a musician? Were you performing?
I was a musician. I actually had a band with Jimmy Crespo, who later joined Aerosmith. This guy, Billy Hawker, who had two albums out on ABC Dunhill and another label called Bulldog. He was the lead singer. Dino Danelli, Gene Cornish from the Rascals were in that band. And then we were playing, and I almost sold my car to make the PA to go on, but he went on to do a record on RCA called Pepper with two other guys, E.T. Thorngren and John Turi, who started Cyndi Lauper, was the player.
So you were just like a garage band?
What was
the town you grew up in?
Professional, Great Neck. East Meadow, then Great Neck.
Hey, Great Neck. Yeah. My mom's from there.
Exactly. Lake Success for me.
You might know her.
Probably.
Do you know Alice Novick? The Novicks. There was Richard Novick and Janie Novick. Those were the siblings.
Well, then they go to Great Neck North. They did. I didn't know them.
Okay,
yeah, that's why it sounds familiar.
But that's it. Lake Success.
But you were in bands in high school.
And then in college, and then I left college, went to work in graphic design in New York. And then I was working in the shows on the weekends with this band. Then I decided after that to try to make some tapes of my own for a record deal. So I was recording in Plaza Sound, which is the recording studio on top of Radio City Music Hall. It's not there anymore. There were the big giant Rockettes rehearsal rooms up there, and one entire room was made into a recording studio. Legend has it that Zeppelin did demos up there, Bonham in one room, one gigantic dance room, Plant in one, Page, John Paul Jones another. McCartney almost did it over Speed of Sound there, but he didn't. But my little sessions, my demo sessions, I would come in, this band was coming out, then I would be leaving, this band was coming in. It was Blondie doing her first album.
Wow.
So that was fun. So I've known them since 1976.
Did you sound like Paul McCartney when you were singing?
No, the stuff I was doing on my own, some of it was pop, but I sang more like, it was harder edge pop. It wasn't, what I did in my cover bands was Free, Bad Company, and my voice is like Paul Rodgers and stuff like that. So I mean, that's what I like to sing. Zeppelin. I cleaned it all up to do the Beatles stuff. It took
a
while.
Did people notice he looked like Paul McCartney?
Yeah, when I did my, in the middle of the set I did with Billy and those guys, we did a little Beatles medley. And the agent said, you should form a McCartney band. This was in 76. I said, well, it's something to think about. You know, I didn't do it, but he was thinking already breaking me out of that band doing a McCartney show. So, I mean, it's I thought the best story about that was, I just told it to somebody yesterday, is in 76, McCartney's doing the big tour, the first big tour. And the last album picture we saw of him was the Red Rose Speedway, where I like to say he has the tendrils. He has this really short cropped hair, and these things that go down like squid legs over his shoulders and a rose in his mouth. So I got myself a haircut somewhere in the middle. And then my dad was a musician, junior, and lawyer, got me tickets to see Wings on Long Island at Nassau Coliseum. And I went early. I used to wear prescription glasses, aviator glasses. I had my haircut, velvet jacket, went with my roommate and two girls to the show. When we walked into the Coliseum at 7 o'clock, the whole staff inside started straightening up. Hey, how are you? Nice to see you.
Oh, wow.
Have a good show tonight. Something like, what the hell is going on here? We walk out into the rotunda. The crew is waving. I mean, all this stuff. And we're going like, this is ridiculous. We get into the stands and he comes out to do, he opens up with Venus and Mars. And my roommate looks at me and goes, shit, that could be you up there. And the girls are like, you've got to be kidding me. He had the same haircut. Same everything.
They just dropped.
It's just like, on the whole audience, the guys are staring at me at the stage. Every down below, all the people in the stands just were like amazed, kept standing back and waving and stuff. Then we're like, get a load of that guy. But I was kind of like, wow, get a load of that guy.
That 28 is crazy. All over again.
Yeah, all over again.
So how did it lead that you got that this whole thing started?
The same thing. Well, it's funny. We didn't mention yet, but I work at Sam Ash Music here in Hollywood now and have for the last 10 years. Great company. Thank you, guys. My friend Andy worked at one of the original ones in Hempstead in the 70s. And he called me in 76 and said, in the summer of 76, and said, hey, there's an ad up here that says, wanted musicians, singers, Beatle lookalikes for unique opportunity, call Mrs. Price. And there was a New York number. So I'm living in my apartment in Forest Hills. And my friend Carl, who was in, Carl Grevenstedt, who owned Pittsburgh Guitars, started Pittsburgh Guitars later on in Pittsburgh, he was with me. He said, you're going to the audition. I go, what? He said, you're going. I called up. I made the audition. I was very shy to the point where he had to drag me. He literally dragged me up in the elevator. We go up, we're at SIR on 54th Street, Manhattan. And they said, and I sang like about 5 or 6 measures of Yesterday and a little bit of Get Back on acoustic guitar. And the guy writing is Kenny Laguna, who's now still Joan Jett's manager, and was back then. He was working with somebody else. So he's writing furiously. I found out years later what he was writing. It looked like he was writing a novel.
Right.
He's writing over and over with a pen. Looks just like him. Sounds close. Just over and over and over. He showed me the paper later on. I think it's Xerox of it somewhere. But they said, would you lose weight? And Carl goes, yes. Can you play left-handed? Yes. I'm like, so I lost weight and I played left-handed, which was interesting as well.
Wow. But, how long did that take to figure that out?
It took a while, and that was what made it more complicated was that I had lefty gear and righty gear.
I meant the weight thing.
Yeah, the weight thing. That, yeah, the weight thing actually went to consomme and rice, I think. That was about it. But also, you're 23 years old.
Oh, yeah. No, Jesus.
But so it was a lot of fun. So,
you did the lefty.
I'm still fighting the weight thing. I did the lefty Hofner songs and the righty Rickenbacker's home, because as much as the money they had in the show, they didn't have everything lefty. But what happened with me was, I was, if you're playing bass left-handed and you get lazy, you can actually flip it upside down and it's easy to figure out to go this way. I had righty basses as well. But what really spazzed it out was, this hand's not so hard. Try and get the left hand to hit the correct string anytime. You want to see how spastic you are. Try to do anything right. with your other hand.
Yeah, no doubt.
Until you practice. So I get lazy and flipped it over, and eventually in Boston, when we did the previews up there after 9 months of rehearsing, the reviewers came on the right hand at night and went, once you get past that, who cares? And I went, like, okay, that's good enough for me. There's enough guys out there who can do it. There weren't any in the beginning. There was a few lefties, and then people taught themselves. The guys in some of the other tribute bands all taught themselves to play left-handed. And I get emails saying, you should play lefty. I said, no, you're doing fine. It's fine.
Yeah.
I have enough identity crisis as it is.
Did the show hit the ground running right away? Because it was, when I was a kid, that was a phenomenon.
We went to...
You were even on Happy Days. He was on Happy
Days.
Yeah,
that was in 78, I think, or later on. I did Johnny Loves Chachi, the spinoff of that. But I did... it went to Boston for 3 weeks.
But in New York, you killed it.
Yeah,
right?
What happened was, we did previews in Boston, went through the roof. So we came to the Winter Garden Theater, a big theater, giant theater. Cats was in there four years later. They papered the house, but the word of mouth built. The television reviews were phenomenal. The paper press was, those days, I mean, you had the Village Voice taking pot shots at us and stuff like that. We were on the Village Voice with these terrible promo shots with big hair and prosthetic noses and for the other guys and things like that. And when Beatlemania, nowhere, man. I mean, it was great. But it was a great article. They took shots of us all over the place. Rolling Stone articles, all this stuff. And I did a lot of TV, radio. A lot of stuff was turned down for me over the years by the producers. They didn't tell me stuff.
Oh, really?
Later cost them money later on.
Do you know what some of the things were that you turned down?
Ringo himself wanted me to be in his 1978 Ognia Rats special that he filmed out here at Tower Records.
He wanted
Records.
You to be in the show.
Yeah, he was going as McCartney. Mm-hmm. He was going to the record.
That's pens. That's a nice compliment.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, Neil Israel, the guys who did all the Airplane movies and stuff like that, he produced that record. They went to Lieber Krebs and said, we want him. They never told me about it. We went to... there was going to be a scene in this record store. He's going through the records and look up, and I say to him, no, you don't want that record, man. You want this one. You know? And hand him his album or something.
What was happening? Were you just too caught up in what was happening to be paying attention?
They were hiding it from him.
They were hiding it from me.
They wanted control.
Fred Silverman from NBC, who had a new TV show to pitch, wanted me to star in it. The conflict of interest came about because they were also my managers. When we were doing the showcases they were the producers of the show, and they became my managers. And the way that came about was, we're doing showcases at SIR for backers. Walter Yetnikoff, Dick Clark, all these people who I've known for years, since Yetnikoff, I think, is gone now. But head of CBS, who put in like $1.7 million to put in for the show, or $700,000 to get it running. Apparently, he had said to them, after seeing me play, great idea for a show. Who's got that guy? And they went, we do. And then they very gingerly spent weeks handing me contracts, publishing, everything else. All the stuff that was 50-50, stuff you even Elton John didn't have back then. Nobody had 50-50. It was all stacked in record companies' favors. I had my publishing. I had this. I had that. And we had it all planned for me to step out and become a solo star. Once, kind of like I said, make me... I actually went with the producers 2 years, the Broadway house manager, to talk with them to say, let's do this like a baseball contract. I'll do Beatlemania for the next 5 years. They'll phase me out. You still manage me, so it'll make me into a star.
Right.
And then if I become big, I'll come back and agree to do it X amount of weeks, a year, or months, and you can make the ticket prices $1 billion, and I'll still get paid whatever the hell you want. And they threw me out of the office.
Mm. How old were you when you started Beatlemania?
23 in rehearsals, turned 24 in that apocalyptic picture from Studio 54.
Did the other guys look like Beatle members as much as you did? No,
they didn't at all. I mean,
it was shocking to see you do that back in the day.
They actually made the show. People thought they made the show around it based on me and my looks and stuff. But I always tell the story. My voice didn't catch up with my face until about 1978. Mm. We had two casts, and somewhere around Thursday, that was it for me. And the other guys would take over. Either the other bands would play two shows and then read. Kaling, the other McCartney, would play with the other guys.
I want you guys to get a taste of what his life was like at 23, 24 years old. So your 24th birthday, what happened that night?
It's right around that time we had the opening of Beatlemania, And we walk in through the front doors after the unofficial opening, and the pictures go, flash rolls go off. So Steven Tyler's with me, the band, the other three guys are with me, Joey, Leslie, and Justin. And then as we're standing there and the flash bulbs are going off and all the disco music, this guy walks over.
You're talking about at Studio 54.
Yeah, this guy asks me, Andy Warhol comes walking over.
Oh, my.
Andy and I have been friends for about 6 months. That's a story in itself. But he comes walking over and says, "What's happening, Mitch?" I go, "The show opened." He says, "Really? Congratulations. Can I be in the picture?" And I went, "Yeah, come on in." You know, so I pull him into the picture. It's a shot of Justin, Joey, Steven Tyler, me, Andy Warhol, and as we're standing, and then Leslie. And as we're standing there taking pictures, the publicist, Susan Blonde from CBS, phenomenal publicist. She handled everybody under the sun. And actually, she was bringing Andy and Michael around together at that point in time to events. This kid comes over, sticks his hand through the between Andy and Leslie and says, "Hi, I'm Michael. Happy birthday."
Oh, my.
I'm going like, I know who you are. It's Michael Jackson. He goes, we all start laughing. And I'm going, I said, how does he know it's my birthday? My dad was an attorney, one of the attorneys in that office. His brother had something to do with the Jacksons. So wow. He asked my dad, Gene Ahrens, so should I have Richard invite Michael to Mitch's party? My dad, not knowing who he was talking about, said, yeah, invite anybody you want.
Oh, wow.
And that's how he showed up. He told me later on that Susan had said to him, well, you're going to the Beatlemania opening. He says, I was already invited. So
unbelievable.
That was pretty
cool. What a party.
So we're recording this as Coachella is starting today, I think, in the Valley.
Yeah.
And I just saw a couple of days ago, I was walking, I don't remember where I was, and there were stores that were advertising Coachella outfits to wear. And it's
a Coachella outfit? Exactly.
Well, it's essentially what you were wearing back in the 70s.
Oh, so they're turning into 70s.
Well, it's like a Woodstocky kind of vibe.
Yeah,
you know?
Really.
It's Woodstocky. It's the 70s. It's Coachella, freedom. It's bikinis.
Wow. Maybe we should play it.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, that would be pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Beatlemania. But,
living that life. So you were living in Manhattan. You were Studio 54. Was
yeah.
A weekly
hanging
thing,
with Michael Jackson.
Hanging with Michael Jackson and Andy Warhol. Did you go to the factory? Were you ever in
I was. We went down. The way I met Andy was I met a guy at Studio named Jeff who had something to do with Andy's business.
You weren't married at this time, were you?
I was.
No, I think
you were.
When did you get married?
I got married after the show opened.
Oh.
We got married at Tavern on the Green. She was a photographer. What did the Daily News say? She's a photographer. He's plays Paul McCartney. Maybe they're taking this a little too far. But it was great. So that was nicer in the Daily News, a little blurb. So, but I met this guy, Jeff, and Jeff says, well, what I do, I work with Andy Warhol. I said, you're kidding me, because I was an art major, went to art school. And I would always see Andy there, because I can't go say hello to him. It's Andy Warhol. And then when I met Jeff, Andy was never with him. And then Jeff wasn't there when Andy was there. So I'm going like, it's missing it. So one night, me, Joe Pecorino, who played John, and his girlfriend, who was the hairdresser for the show, and my wife were sitting in my apartment on 74th Street off Central Park West, and the phone rings. Pick up the landline, and I hear all this disco music, and a voice goes, hi, Mitch. Yeah? It's Andy. Andy who? It's Andy Warhol. Right. Hi, Andy Warhol. Well, how can I help you? You know, he's going, and I'm going, we're all laughing. He's like, well, when are you coming down? Coming down to where? Coming down to the studio. Well, Andy Warhol, I'm having dinner right now, but when I'm done, I'll be sure to come down and meet you at Studio 54. Okay, Andy Warhol? Okay, Mitch. He hangs up the phone. We're dying of laughter, Andy Warhol.
Great. Right.
The phone rings 30 seconds later, the same music, and it's Jeff. He says, Mitch, it's Jeff. I'm going, are you shitting me? He goes, yeah, you want to talk to Andy now? Yeah, put him on the phone. Andy, Mitch, we'll be right down. Like the Keystone Cops, we threw everything into the sink and ran down five flights of stairs. Taxi! That's how I first met him.
Wow.
So we Jeff and I went down to pick up Andy a couple of times at the factory.
Did you get to see him work at all?
No, not at all. And I'd be sitting at Studio 54 with Andy Warhol and Jeff and Liza Minnelli and Halston and...
So you're hanging out with these people, but the right...
I'm quiet as hell, because what the hell am I doing at this table?
Right.
But they all seemed to admire what you were doing.
They did. I get all these huge compliments from people going like, wow. I mean...
What are they saying?
Going like, I'm a big fan of yours. I'm going like, thank you, Gene Simmons, or who was it who told me the first one? Diane Keaton. All these people
and they know it's you, or they think it's Paul.
No, they definitely know. Some of them knew the real guy.
Right.
I mean,
Lennon,
again, because I was
John
there.
John Lennon and I were neighbors, so we had a lot of fun talking about all that stuff in the streets.
Yeah, there's a good John Lennon story too. But I don't know how to say it. It was among the most memorable experiences of my life to see you do that.
Yeah,
and when I think of performing today, we perform, there's a couple of people that I remember how comfortable they were on stage, and I try and emulate what they were doing. You were definitely one
coming
of them.
Coming down, because when yesterday at the front of the stage, you literally they took out four seats, so you put your hang off the edge of the stage, and you're the person
that was
I'm closer
thing.
Than to you. My feet are like dangling between the legs,
right?
And you're trying. It's like people are looking up at you. You can see everything because the spotlight's on you. It's illuminating everything. And you're like, holy crap! And you try not to be nervous, but you get used to it, which is odd because I can't play in his living room, but I can play in front of thousands of people. It's just it's interesting like that. So it was a lot of fun. I mean, meeting all those people was great. But having them give you the compliments is like,
there was a John Lennon relationship. Yeah. Right, Do you want to ask about that?
Well, I want to ask about that, but I'm also interested in just so. You know, with your own, you're coming of age, you are Mitch, but there's a lot of this Paul going on here. I mean, are you thinking, do they like me for me? Am I that good? Is it just because I look like Paul? I mean, are you working through any of this, or are you just like, doing good?
I'm doing a job. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I know who I am by myself. The funny thing is, when the show was over, I didn't wear the Beatlemania jacket. I didn't wear the swag. I didn't wear that stuff. It just seemed to be like overkill. Right. I had the face. I couldn't take that off to begin with. So, and people would go like, I mean, I told this same story to my friend Andrew, who I work with at the store. Before the show opened, when I had that sunglasses and the haircut that was McCartney's in the 76 tour, we would go to, my family took Sunday lunch to brunch to the World Trade Center, Windows on the World. I'm standing at the window looking at the view. With his, you know, Sally sports coat, whatever it was, his sunglasses, looking out the window, and a waiter comes up behind me, says, "So, nice view, huh?" I says, "Yeah, you know, your friend was here last week." I go, "What friend?" And I'm talking in American, and there's no English, British accent. Like, you know, your friend, John Lennon, was here last week. I'm going like, "I'm not who you think I am." "Yep, okay, I get it. But it's nice to have you here and enjoy your meal." I'm going like, so, I mean, there's things like that. I mean, I'm seeing Aerosmith, it was my label mates, my management mates, at this is again before the show's open, or at Madison Square Garden, people are passing me joints.
Right.
I didn't smoke at that time. I'm passing them to all the other guys.
And they're like, "We smoked with Paul McCartney."
Yeah, yeah. I'm at Max's Kansas City seeing my friend Binky Phillips, who was in a band called The Planets back then. Now he does a lot of commentary and stuff for the Post. And I'm sitting at a table, and Rex Smith is the teen idol, as you take my breath away, and all this stuff back then, and we're sitting there, and people are passing me up pieces of paper to sign as Paul McCartney.
Right.
And this girl says to him, "Can you think you can sign this?" She goes, "Listen, be calm, be calm, because if you make a lot of commotion, he's going to have to leave."
Right.
So I'm quietly signing all the best Paul McCartney. I actually could do his signature back then, stuff like that. I would actually visit restaurants of people that knew him. And
get free meals.
No, but I'd leave messages for Ashley, who owned Ashley's downtown. He'd come and say, "Hey, Paul left me a note last night." No, that was me.
You were like an ambassador for Paul McCartney, too.
I thought to myself, I better be nice because it's going to reflect on him.
Did he ever talk to you? Have you ever had any interaction?
The only interaction I ever had with him was when I was working at the first Sam Ash down at 8000 Sunset. I'm carrying coffee, got a big beard, totally not. This is 2003 or 4. I'm walking out the door of Buzz Coffee. And down the escalator in that plaza comes Paul McCartney. And I'm walking to the door. He comes to the door. He opens it up. He goes, "Come ahead, man." You know, and I walk out with my coffee going, "Nah, this isn't the time." You know?
Yeah.
So he knew who I was because he told stories in the New York Post that he loves to take the subways and stuff like that. And because that's what he did when he grew up in London. And they said, you know, when people come up to me on the subway and say, "You that guy from Beatlemania?" I go, "Yes." And they leave me alone.
So, right.
Are you Mitch Weissman?
Yeah, that's awesome. He was the Mitch Weissman impersonator.
So at times he would use it to get out of being Paul McCartney.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, so at that time, I mean, you've just told some stories where people are refusing to believe that you're not Paul McCartney. Yeah.
But
so,
I made a lot of fans because people did know. I'd always say that I was.
Right.
And the people would always go, "You do a great job." But there's always those people who go, "Oh my God, you look, I mean, that's him." Right. Before the show opened, we had scenes of me and Joe and Sam Goody's on 6th Avenue and a bunch of girls seeing us on the street or me and start chasing it, like the opening credits to Hard Day's Night. We're running back to the theater to get the hell off the street before you get tackled. I mean,
so how did you, I mean, you're married at this time. How do you stop the onslaught of women that are probably coming after you?
I was a very nice Jewish boy from Long Island, brought up, you know, I'm monogamous. That's the way I was.
Right.
My ex at the
how
time.
How tempting was it?
It wasn't that much because it could have been. By 1978 in Los Angeles, we weren't married at the time when the show first opened on Broadway. We got married in November of that year. So we opened on Broadway in June. I remember coming out the stage door, my fiance at the time would be off in the back, and the girls are going, oh, and they'd say, are you married? I go, no, but I'm engaged. And you hear the whole big, oh, but I was able to turn it around and say, no, but you know, you shouldn't say anything like that. And she had, at one point, she had more fan mail than I did.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting that happened that way. And then one time, I'm coming out the back door to meet my dad, and this woman, I'm like 23 or whatever it was, this woman comes up to me and says, can I give you a kiss? I'm like, okay. She was like 30 years old. She was like, oh my God, like a 30-year-old woman's got to kiss me.
Yeah.
It plants one on me. I'm like, and my dad goes, are you sure you want to get married? I said, yes, I did. So I've been that way in the relationship. And I'm now, same sort of thing. So, you know,
yeah.
of course, I'm not the same guy, but you know.
There's so much more to his story. But before you do that, real quick, can you just share with people listening and with Sadie and Adam, how did John Lennon and you get to know each other? What was that? Because I know you had some moments with him.
I lived on 74th Street off Central Park West, and he, of course, was in Dakota on 72nd. So I would walk around the neighborhood, and my planned route was always in the morning. If I went to and from the theater, I'd get off at the 72nd Street bus stop, walk up to Columbus Avenue, up to the Pioneer Supermarket, and then back to 74th Street, and then back to my apartment, which was the brownstone behind the San Remo. First building in off Central Park West, past the massive apartment building. So I would not see him, but one morning, it's a snowstorm in 1978, before we went to California. And or was it 77? I can't tell. It had to be 78. I'm coming out of my apartment, five flights, out to the hardware store, and I'm like a woman in curlers. Got my glasses on, my hair is disheveled, bell bottoms from 1976. I mean, all the things where you go out to go, God, I hope I don't run into anybody I know. And I'm walking to go to the Pioneer Market. I go get this curtain rods and stuff in a bag. I get up to the corner, coming up Columbus Avenue, and coming down from 75th Street. And Ruel's, which is a great restaurant people would go to all the time, comes John and Yoko and a third guy. And as I get to the corner, my brain is going, holy shit, it's John Lennon. And I get to about the holy shit point, and this voice booms out, well, good morning, Paul. How are you, Paul? Look, honey, it's Paul. And I'm like, and I'm standing there. He literally took me out of the street back up onto the curb because I'm standing there. And he starts talking about, look, honey, he looks just like Paul, doesn't he? She goes, yes, he does. And we're sitting there, and he talks about how he's 16-year-old had seen the show, Julian at the time, says, Dad, the guy who plays you doesn't look much like you, but you got to see the guy who plays Paul. Looks just like him. And he turns to the guy with him and says, they were thinking of doing something, some sort of television special or something like that.
Right.
Said, you know, we should use him on this television thing. And I'm going, like, I live down the block. He goes, I'm carrying my groceries and curtain rods. And,
yeah.
And he goes, that's not a fun. He says, you know, you should form a band. You should form a band with four guys and a chick singer who look like no one and call it Wings and Tour the World. And I said, like, I think it's been done. No, you should do that. You should form a band and do that. So he asked me how I was doing. How could we sing all those shows? Because his last remembrances was how miserable it was to be on stage.
Right.
I said, well, we have monitors. He said, no, I don't know how you could do that. So that's when I first saw him. And when he walked, he and Yoko disappeared down the street with the other gentleman. I'm standing there. It becomes a Jerry Lewis moment. There's no one in the street. It's totally white. It's from snow, plows, and stuff like that. There's no one on the street at all. I'm going like, like I'm like the guy in Ice Age with the nut. I run down the block, hop over some guy with a hose, hosing down the sidewalk. I get to my apartment building. I run up the five flights of stairs, and now I'm Lou Costello. What? Speak slowly. You know, I got it out. So then everybody called everybody. But look, you met John Lennon. So that was the first time I met him.
Wow.
I literally shook from head to toe. Then there were two subsequent meetings where I only shook from the waist down.
Yeah.
The third one was 2 weeks before he was killed.
Oh, wow.
I had gotten off the same bus visiting. I was on tour in 1980, and I'd come back for November for...
You're on tour with Beatlemania?
With Beatlemania, the bus and truck company of it. And I had come off the road for Thanksgiving break. So I'd gone to visit the boys on Broadway, come off the bus again at the 72nd Street stop, and start walking past the Dakota. And he and Yoko, this is his third meeting, start walking towards me from towards their apartment building. And I had just listened to A Double Fantasy the night before and read the Playboy article. And they said, and I see them coming. I'm like, "Hey, kids, how you doing?" They come running over towards me. Yoko comes over, gives me a hug. John says, "Hey, you know, we're suing you again." And I went like feigning, you know, "Oh, what are you suing me for?" She goes, no, it's just the lawyers. It's just the lawyers. Yeah, he kept getting lawyers about suing stuff. And he didn't care. He used to say, "If you want to see Beatlemania, go see those guys. If you want to see the Beatles, go see those guys. They play better than we ever did."
Wow.
Because we have to be
John
perfect.
John Lennon is saying that.
Saying that, yeah. I think that's why he said to me, "You want to do this thing on TV?" Back a year before that. But we sat on the stoop right by that guard tower and invited me. We walked, turned around, walked back. I told him I'd read the Playboy article. And he grabs Yoko and he's in the middle. Yoko and I are looking at each other, talking to him on the sides. He goes like this, like the parents stopping the kid in the front seat. Says, "Uh-oh, that's it. George is going to kill me." I'm going, "What do you mean?" He says, "Because George," in that interview, he kind of lashed out at everybody talking about that George was no more different than all the Apple Scruff girls that used to hang out in front of it, because he used to hang around the art college trying to get him and Paul to pay attention to him. So then I said, I kind of agree also maybe that Yoko was ahead of her time with like the DB-52s and stuff like that. He goes, "Yeah, she was always ahead of her time with all that stuff." And she's laughing and he's imitating her. And we sit down on the stoop. We start talking. "Are you still doing the show?" I said, "Yeah, I'm still trying to do it." And he says, And I said, "But I am trying to get out." At that point, I was trying to make my exit. He says, "I can feel for you." I said, "I've been there myself." I said, "Come on, let's be honest. The scale's a little bit different." He says, No. "It doesn't matter what scale it's on. When you're a Beatle, it's just as tough to get out." And that, then he was dead 2 weeks later. And Meredith Vieira actually interviewed me in front of the, I was up with my friends, my wife and Joey all night long in front of Dakota. That's how I met Eastside. That's another story.
You know, by the way, Sadie, When John Lennon died and they were having the vigils outside the Dakota, there was a young guy.
It was the pandemonium at that first night.
Sitting outside crying and singing, and he saw Mitch, and they started hugging, and it turned out to be a teenage Isai Morales.
Yeah. Who said to me, he said, "You don't know me." He says, he knew who I was. I didn't know who he was just before he did Bad Boys, before he did anything. And he said, "My life is over. My idol is dead. I don't know what I'm going to do. What do I do? What can I do?" And it was, again, it's like, okay, there's a guy who looks like the Beatle. I know who that guy is. I'll ask him. Mm-hmm. I'll ask Paul McCartney. What should I do in that John's?
And you said, "Go see Beatlemania."
No, I said, "No, you cheated." I see
three shows weekly.
No, I actually said to him, I said, "You know, you have to go on. That's not what he would have wanted." I mean, and he later on, he told me that that's the speech that got him to become what he became.
Wow.
We'd meet each other at the China Club and stuff, and there was some events at the Limelight. And one night I went down there for something else, and he came. He said, "Wait right here." And he came back.
Talk about Isai?
Yeah, Isai. And he comes with his family. "Mommy, Bobby, come. I got tackled by the family. They start crying and everything else. If it wasn't for you, my son would be." I'm going, like, I swear it sounds insane.
Did I reintroduce you guys? Is that how it happened?
Yeah, you were doing your record and we called him on the phone.
Oh, that's right.
He just responded to my upcoming nuptials request. He's in the middle of negotiations for a movie.
Yes, Mitch is about to get married again.
To a lovely,
to a lovely artist.
Yes, very Jackie Stanton. Artist. Very good.
Is she gallerying in L.A.?
She is a pop-up gallery at the moment. She's a little bit... She's got several galleries she still shows in, but right now we're concentrating on the wedding, so...
Had she seen Beatlemania? Did she meet you at Beatlemania?
No, she was... Just
young.
Being born? Like... yeah, she wasn't around when Beatlemania was around. So she had no idea who the hell I was. She was a John Lennon fan.
She experiences Beatlemania every night
she's
now.
I don't know. It's like Beatlemania, it's waning.
Yeah.
Well, so, okay.
But
so
the relationship is strong.
Yay, man. That's what I'm talking about.
So look, he went from Beatlemania to Kiss.
Yeah, that was a transaction. And singing on Aerosmith
transaction.
Records.
Oh, you sing on Aerosmith Records?
Aerosmith Records. And,
what'd you sing on?
I'm singing on Kings and Queens off of what's that? The one that had the Al Hirschfeld cover, which almost killed them. It was right after Rocks. They had a third album, right, or fourth album after that. But they were, you know, they're my friends. I sang Come Together with them live in concert once on stage.
At one of the giant stadiums?
No, it was actually when they opened a supper club uptown called Tracks, called Privates.
So these were all people you were coming up with in the 70s?
Yeah, they were all my friends I would see in the... Well, I would go to these parties and go like, what the hell am I doing in this fucking room? Why am I here?
As a Beatle, were you hating on the Monkees at that time? Were you they're frauds?
I love the Monkees.
I think the Beatles, we were outspoken about liking the Monkees.
We got backlash from real musicians because it seemed like a prefab sort of thing,
yeah.
Like Monkees, until the show hit, and then all the real musicians showed up to audition.
Oh.
Because what really happened in the beginning was there were very few guys that acted and sang and looked like them. There were a lot of guys that looked phenomenal.
Couldn't do it.
But at the auditions, you had like Puerto Rican guys, you had black guys, you had Hispanic guys. One guy, an actor, came in looking like the shaved Fish Leonard with the short hair and the glasses that, you know, went from dark to light. And he looks phenomenal. He's playing Come Together on acoustic guitar, but it was just like, come to, turning the page, together. You know, I mean, so it's like, so there were guys that looked great. There were guys that sounded great, didn't look anything like a Beatle. So we got picked in the middle. And then after subsequent casts, I would like to say, probably were better than the first cast.
But tell us about working with other people. So were you writing songs? Is that how that happened?
I wrote the stuff I was doing on my demos that I ended up putting aside. John Travolta's brother Joey had an album coming out in the 70s. He actually covered two of my songs. And then the album didn't come out.
He was in Stayin' Alive, right? He bumped into John Travolta in the street.
I don't know. I think that's
his famous scene.
Yeah. His scene, I think that's it, yeah. So, and they weren't pushing me to I actually was able to compartmentalize myself and not write. Joe was always asking me, how do you not write? I go, because my brain goes like, you're not going to do anything with this now, so enjoy this and you'll do it later. When the show was over, I started writing, and then that's when I wrote with Paul and Gene and the Kiss albums and other guys. Desmond Child and I didn't write, but D.L. Byron, who wrote Shadows of the Night and a bunch of hits back then. We wrote some stuff together. Those songs didn't place either. But I was writing with different people, and also I was very, very shy. I didn't know how to write like that. I mean, it really, my life, you know, I'm writing on a Porter studio. You think it sounds like shit. And yet it became like it became like the Chopin' Broccoli set.
Chopin' Broccoli.
Well, yeah, with the, what's his name?
Adam Sandler, right?
No.
Who did Chopin' Broccoli?
Martin Short.
No, the other guy, what's his name? He's going to kill me now. He's going to kill me.
Were you guys on Saturday Night Live?
No, we didn't. They put the, Lauren Michaels did the, request to get the Beatles back together with George Harrison, and I'll pay you like $3,500, and you can pay Ringo less. And we responded. I wrote the letter. Dear Lauren, we will play instead of the Beatles for $3,500, and we will pay our Ringo less. And but I never was on set. I was a lot of backstages when everybody else I knew was hosting, but I was not on Saturday Night Live. The closest it came was in...
You did Fridays, right?
Did Fridays, yeah.
With Larry David, I think.
Larry David is a temp Beatles sketch.
Yeah, that was funny.
The closest my reference came on Saturday Night Live was McCartney was doing it in 90-something. And Chris Farley, you know that show when he has people on? So he had McCartney on and says, did you ever see that show, Beatlemania? And McCartney goes, well, yes. Do you ever know about that show? And he goes, yes. Yeah, I know about it. Did you ever see the guy who played you? And he says, no. He says, God, he played just like you. And that was I saw that on the run-through taping, the dress rehearsal taping. On the show that went out, McCartney had that line removed, the reference to Beatlemania removed, and me. Did you ever see that guy who plays you? That was removed from there. I took it out of the script.
So why didn't you end up making your own records?
Sidetracked, wrong decisions, doing what you think is right. The Kiss stuff.
Dana Carvey,
thank you very much.
Sorry.
He's going to kill me. It really became that way because after the Kiss records came out, people were calling me from around the world to send demos and stuff like that. They handled my publishing here or collected for me.
What was your Kiss character?
The sidekick, I guess. I'm not sure.
Did you wear makeup?
No, I didn't. No, no. This was when they didn't have
the fox.
They didn't have makeup then. No.
pre-Kiss makeup.
After Kiss makeup.
Kiss makeup started. Yeah, it started makeup, right?
It started makeup, yeah.
And then went away from makeup and came back to makeup. Yeah.
Do you remember the Phantom of the Park?
Yes, I.
You mean the amusement park movie?
Yes.
Oh, that was the greatest. Yeah. I still have not been able to find that.
Some great. It's online. Anthony Zerba.
It is online.
Yeah, it's online. You can get it. You can download it.
Damn.
Kiss Meets the Phantom.
That was like the show.
Unbelievably terrible movie, but it was. Yeah. But
at that
they
time,
had some quality actors in it too, which was funny. That, and those guys were right.
Yeah, do you think it's possible to do, kind of rebring, like, has there been anything close to what was happening in New York in the 70s with all those incredible artists and musicians and all that excitement? Some of the firsts were being
done. I would say when we came out here in 1978, my life was just as surreal with the people I would run into and meet and hang out with. I lived on Shoreham Drive, which was right up the hill from Tower Records. And that restaurant is in the middle of the, which is now World something or other. It was a place where everybody went and you sat outside and had breakfast. I would come down the hill, have breakfast with Robert De Niro.
You mean where that guys, it used to like be that. Red Rocks thing?
Well, it was Red Rocks and now it's something else.
Yeah, yeah.
But before that, it just was this restaurant in the middle there. People go have breakfast in the morning. And those were the sort of people that are having breakfast in the morning. So it's like insane. So that was your neighborhood. You walk around, it was the same sort of thing.
But when you came out here, were you trying to get into acting more or were you trying to be?
I came out here in 78 during Beatlemania at the Schubert. So when I never really came out here to do the acting thing, except when I did Joni Lovechachi, ABC offered me a contract deal, one of the last ones. Tony Tamopoulos, the president of the network, said, if you want to come back out here to Paramount, we'll give you a deal. And going into the commissary with Sly Stallone and everybody else sitting there, I remember being introduced to Gary Marshall came to take me to meet his sister Penny at the Laverne and Shirley set and stuff like that. And Henry Winkler and I talking when I went to visit everybody on that set. So they
This is
me to
very
do this.
Rare because I've known Mitchell really, 30 years, and he's not this open about who he spoke about. He knows that I love hearing the names.
Yeah, and
so
it's funny,
I always ask him,
it's
who
not
does
really
he
a
know?
It's not really a drop. I mean, there was a period in my life that I...
It just was.
It was, and people would ask me, from my friends from childhood, said, what'd you do last night? And you'd go like, I watched TV. Because if you said what you did and who you were with, it sounds like a really bad... There was a Mary Tyler Moore episode where she leaves Lou in a hotel room because all of his old contacts are dead. So when she comes back, the room is obviously at a party. And you got Lyndon Johnson, and you got Hubert Humphrey, and you got all these people in the room, like John Glenn.
Right.
And she's going, sure, Lou. Yeah. And the phone rings, and it's a cross screen of Lady Bird. Not Lady Bird, it's actually, yeah, Lady Bird. Hi, Mary, this is whatever. She goes like, hi, this is Mary, Queen of Scots. Did my husband leave his pipe? No, it's Betty Ford. So all those people, there wasn't Lindsay, but they're all in this room. So sure enough, there's the president's pipe. Oh, what do you know? It's the pipe. Of course, we all know that she started, she doesn't know.
Right.
But it's kind of like, sure, Mr. Grant, whatever you have to do to say that. I'm not kidding. It really was. You know. So the Secret Service sends a car over, but right. She hangs up on Betty Ford.
So this was your life in Hollywood.
Yeah, and even in New York. It's like I'm hanging with parties. Paul Stanley threw an Oscar party at his apartment, and I'm there with Christopher Walken, Bruce McGill, so-and-so. And this is Walken came in right after the Natalie Wood drownings. I mean, so it was all like...
Which, by the way, they've just revealed the truth about the Natalie Wood drownings yesterday.
What's the truth? I didn't know.
I didn't read it. I was caught up on
killed her?
I was caught up on the Loch Ness Monster thing.
Yeah, exactly.
They found the Loch Ness Monster, but then it turned out not to be the Loch Ness Monster. It was from some British TV show in the 70s that they buried in the lake there.
Really?
Yeah, so I kind of got a little rabbit hole.
That's good.
So, all right. So, how did you transition? After that, are you writing today? What are you up to today? I know you're performing.
I'm not writing that much today. There's not a lot of time with a real job. However, the next thing that's coming up, supposedly in reality, it's been delayed, is this new venture called the Classic Wrestling Revolution, CWR, which is started by my friend Bill Townsend and Roddy Piper, who has since
Roddy.
So. Bill asked me to get involved with that and become part of the house band. And basically, it's another wrestling federation, but much smaller and more true to the old style wrestling. And a lot of the people from WWE, Shane Douglas, and all these other people coming over to be coaches. It's going to be at the Rio Hotel.
Mm.
And I got to meet Roddy across the street at Aroma when Bill said, come meet everybody. And I got to tell Roddy, I said, I really loved your movies. He goes, and you still like me? I said, yeah. Because those movies are horribly campy, but he was great. But unfortunately, he's passed away. So,
yeah.
But in his honor, this thing is going on, supposedly. So we'll see what happens.
And so what would what would you have to do?
I'll be the house band. I get to be, like to say, I get to be Will Lee. I get to be the bass player in this project. We will write the intros and outros for all these wrestlers, play the music live in the ring. So I thought that was my
Charlie. My dog is here and rubbing over the dog here at Meltdown.
Meltdown is dog friendly, dog by friendly, the way. So yes. meltcomics.com. Check it out.
So do you reflect really fondly on that time in your life?
I do. I do, and I actually don't. It was a part of my life that happened. It existed, and I don't cling to it because I'm just me, and I've gone on from that. I did the Kiss stuff. I did that. I didn't do the Thermopolis ABC deal because my dad had liver cancer, and at the time, I didn't feel like I wanted to move out there and leave him. So and there was, and as far as I was concerned, there's plenty of time. I mean, it's I'm 30 something. It's like, is that the end of my life now? No. The Kiss songs were making money. I'd eventually get asked to write on different projects, but get delayed. I mean, my relationship I was in at that time after the Kiss records, I get a call from John Bon Jovi and Richie Sambora on a conference call saying, Paul Stanley says we should write with you. And after 8 years of that relationship and it was in trouble and I'm got money coming in the bank, I said, I can't. It's bad timing. So Desmond Child went to go write with him because he'd wrote on that album also, on Animalize. And he turned into Sir Desmond Child. And Slippery When Wet sold 17 million copies.
Would that have been the album you would have worked on?
Yeah. Now, it makes a great story because I turned it down. I did the thing what it wanted to do. And the relationship a year later was done, and they were the biggest rock band in the world.
Well, have you ever heard the story of Brenda Lee Ager turning down Bridge Over Troubled Water?
No, but it makes sense. It's like actors turning down this movie role for, you know, who knows what would have happened.
So yourself today, how do you go back to your 20-something self and tell them to, what's your advice about identifying the right situation? And by the way, normally at this point we would have you play some music. We don't have any guitars here. Nobody minds, I'm going to go deep and get some advice because I never get to ask
what I decided to do, with it's funny.
Because I always wonder about that stuff.
I was very cognizant of how to tell people what to do or give them advice on following my lead and what I didn't do and something. It may work, it may not. But basically, I narrowed it down after a lot of years of doing everything because I self-doubted myself. I mean, I'm in with these people, but what the hell do I know? So you find out that people that you think are your equals or treating like your equals, when it comes time for you to move a little bit faster, they'll give you advice that keeps you where you are. Because I'm not being cynical, but there's people that want you not to get to be an equal.
Do you remember any of that advice or what someone said specifically?
Just specifically, it would be, well, you don't want to do this, you want to do that. And I go, okay, maybe I should. But at the end of the day, the advice that I think everybody should try to do is, if it comes down to, and I did this from, the only thing I never really did was, okay, go with your instinct. But I spent a lot of time figuring out why my instinct may not be the right way to go. And after years and years, I went like, well, I'm just going to do it this way now because that's the only way I haven't tried. What's the worst that can happen? The same exact thing. I actually had people in my life for a time, and it was a very it was a very good time. I had a group of people that if they all said you're out of your mind, that was the way to go. So instead of being angry, thank you, okay, think about it. And that was the barometer. Thank you for telling me I'm crazy. Again, we're going that way, in the other direction. And almost always, it was the right way to go. But so you trust it. But certain things take you away, certain sidesteps, certain, you know, things you do. Then, in my case, in the 80s, sidetracked with too much fun, too much libation, too much drugs, too much whatever it might be, chasing the wrong direction stuff, and just staying inebriated out of it, but not having $1 million to come out of it at the end. So you make some mistakes. I'd like to think that if I had had the money that some superstars have and blow it all, I couldn't possibly have gone through all that. So I've learned how to live very, very modestly and be happy and healthy and get insurance.
Do you think do you think working at Sam Ash, because you said you've been there for 10 years, has that been a pretty good steady influence on you?
It has its plus and minuses. I mean, I'm ready for something. It has its ups and downs. It changes. It's a family-owned business who, when I first called to say, do you have any openings? They were thrilled to have me in there. But you find out that's, you know these guys when you used to shop at their store and they were an equal that way and because you know them from way back when, but they're still your bosses and they're still whatever it is. And when you're however old I am and you're not the kid and you expect maybe a little bit more respect of that or so-and-so, but it all comes because of what you do.
Right.
So that's how I developed my stuff. It wasn't because I was new Sammy Ash or Richard Ash or those guys. As a matter of fact, in the beginning, it's like, oh God, here's one of them, one of their friends. And it's always the same. They said that what made you apart from them was it's like, oh God, another recommendation from Sammy or Richard, which is always the cousin who can't get a job, this buddy's, this person's son, this person's uncle, this person, and none of them ever work out. And it's like, okay, oh God, not him. And they went like, it was a pleasant surprise. You were recommended by him, but you had nothing to do with all the other guys who are out there. So yeah, I did him proud, or so to speak, but I did myself proud. I came to do the job.
Has there been somebody that when you first started there, that's actually gone on to become a really popular musician that you kind of helped along the way?
They're not really, because nobody really left that show to become that way.
No, with you, it's Sam Ash, when you're seeing like a young guitar player.
Oh,
you put the first guitar in their hand. You're like,
no, not yet. I don't think so. No one has come. I mean, I've given stuff to guys. No, I don't think so. Because right about now, it's not about the guitar gunslinger. In Hollywood, people come to buy the stuff there. There's some young guys that are poised to go somewhere, but there are guys I've given advice to who come back and tell me, if it wasn't for you, this wouldn't have happened. Even older guys and stuff like that. Thanks for the hookup. Thanks for that. You know, it's like I used to have a card say, have knowledge, will travel. People say, well, how would you do this? This, and they come because, and I'll get money. It's like finder's fees. Wow, that was amazing advice. It worked exactly the way you're going to do it. You know, so, and the same thing with giving people advice on what not to do and tell them, this is going to go this way, this is going to go that way, and then this is going to happen, this is going to go, and they come back, call me. The conversation, the whole thing went exactly word for word the way you said it was going to go. How did you know that? I said, I just know the person you're dealing with. Mm. This is what they're going to do.
I have a question. Sadie and I spent a lot of time working on our harmonies. What is the secret to that Beatles harmony?
It was very intuitive. I don't think even they realized what they were doing. It was, a lot of it was country oriented, and the thirds and fifths. A lot of it was,
who would they listen to that would really?
Chet Atkins, those sort of things. They listened to Big Bill Brunzi. They listened to a lot of Elvis, a lot of stuff. Not a lot of harmony stuff. I think Paul may have gotten it because his dad was more into music, theater, and dance hall stuff. There's Everly Brothers was the harmonies where they really got it from. So again, country. All that sort of stuff came from there. They used to do something which they jumped around vocals. So in the beginning, the part you thought would, the high part associated with Paul would cross with John, and he'd take over the high part. And I remember when I was musical directing a show called Lennon at the Intermedia Theater in the 80s, guys like Vincent Irizarry from ABC Soap Opera, David Patrick Kelly, who was in The Warriors and now starring on Broadway and a whole bunch of stuff, all these guys that became real actors, and I was the musical director, were asking me, how do you do the songs? And please me, there's a whole lot of cross stuff going on there. And one of them didn't believe me. So one of the guys in the show was Greg Martin, George Martin's son. He got the role on his own. He was a very good-looking, tall, blonde guy. And after he told us afterwards, he spelled his name Martyn to have his own identity. And when he got the role, he said, I'm George Martin's son. So when we were rehearsing on top of Radio City Music Hall again, always back to that building somehow, in one of the rooms for the Intermedia show, in comes George Martin to meet everybody and talk to us. And so we're wrapped, he's telling us stories, we're telling him what we're doing, and one of the actors who doubted me on the vocal part says, Mr. Martin, I have a question. When they're doing Please Please Me, can you tell us how they sang the vocals? And he goes, well, it has been quite a few years. I wouldn't know where to begin. I said, Mr. Martin, would you mind if I gave you my opinion? And I said, part goes like this, crosses to here, please, please me, and all this crossing stuff. And then I give him the headphones on a Walkman. And he listens to the headphones, and the best compliment of my life probably still is, took off the headphones and went, I would listen to this young man if I were you, because that's exactly the way they sound.
How do you describe that process? Because I always, when again, like so much of what we write together is harmony based, and we really have been. That's our main mission, is to get those crossing harmonies, because we love that stuff. But how do you describe that visually? Because that's the part that I always struggle with.
I will, for me as a writer, I would always come up with the music almost first and some melody line. The lyrics came last. There are some guys the lyrics come first. I always like trying to. The challenge would be to write with somebody who gives me lyrics and say, okay, put this to music. Think about it that way. Bernie Taupin writes all these lyrics and Elton John then creates the music to it. How do you do that? How do you just take words and start coming up with this stuff? I don't know. I mean, I can do it now, but it was unfathomable to me. So I'd have a hook, I'd have a line, write the music, start humming stuff, port a studio, start the overdub stuff back then. Or I didn't have a friend to sing the stuff. Joey and I would sometimes do harmonies on his demos. I wasn't really doing too many demos then. And that's how it would work. With the Kiss stuff, the same sort of thing. For Billy Squire's albums, I actually, for the album Enough is Enough, I stayed and he went to go record with the album over in London. And I stayed behind with his keyboard player, Alan St. John, and started singing stuff, just scat singing. Billy and I first did it in his apartment, and then the vocal lines would appear. By the time we went to England, I had arranged all the vocals. And then I got to sing with Freddie Mercury, so that was kind of crazy. So
you got to sing with Freddie Mercury?
Not in the same room. He sang his parts. He was very shy. He wasn't ill yet. But he sang his parts, and then we came in and sang with him. And it was pretty amazing. That was kind of cool, because he had our parts already sent over. So he weaved his vocals in and out of my vocal parts.
See, I've always wanted us to work with Mitch and to try and have him sit down with one of our songs and figure out how to do this.
Let's do it.
I guess I'm doing it. No excuses, folks. You heard it here.
So when does that happen?
Well, he's getting married in a month and a half.
But less.
We're actually working on our acoustic record right now. Yep. And we've been kind of slowly getting into it. But we started studying the Everly Brothers and Crosby, Stills, and Nash and all that stuff. So it's...
Are you guys going to primarily just do duo? Is there not a third person anymore, or is there? No.
Just us.
It can be...
Pistol and Dagger.
It's...
And Mitch. Yeah.
And Mitch.
Yeah, maybe.
I've gotten to sing with you before. It's been really fun.
Remember when we were trying to teach Kiki?
Yeah.
And so it was Brenda and I singing.
Yeah.
Telling her how to do that stuff too.
Yeah.
And trying to get her to just naturally come out that way. I mean, I think my strength is mainly what I'd love to do it if I can, is drawing out what would come out naturally, and not necessarily telling you what to sing. But if you work from the melody line first, and then everybody takes a shot at harmonies, mm-hmm. something may just come out that's magical. And have the tape running, because there's a lot of stuff. I have those stories. Wake up in the middle of the night. Thank God. Keith Richards had the I'm running on a cassette for 30 minutes. Sleeping sounds. He wakes up, picks his guitar up, plays the riff, goes back to bed. I would wake up, write entire songs, and write the chord structure down on my guitar at like 4 in the morning. And the next morning, I wake up and go, what the hell does this mean?
But you would do... She wants to do our whole album on cassette. That's her dream.
It can be done.
That's your dream, Sadie?
That's a little exaggerated.
Isn't that your dream to do a cassette thing?
I said I would like to. Yes, absolutely.
It can be done on cassette, and it can be, and you can move stuff in. You can go do port studio again. You can do four tracks mm-hmm. and bounce them. When I used to do my demos with Gene, they were noisy, but literally I was...
So Gene Simmons, huh?
Yeah.
How is he to work with?
He was great to work with
really?
Then.
Okay.
The stories of it now, I don't know.
Okay.
I saw him in my doctor's office. Yeah.
He's got a lot of controversial stuff he's been saying lately about hip-hop.
Yeah.
Gene Simmons, what's he saying?
Yeah, he says he can't wait for it to die, and it's ready for it to die. It's some stuff
he
like
says
that.
He says a lot of stuff because he just says a lot of stuff.
Yeah, he's like Donald Trump in that way.
Yeah, it's funny, when I was with him, it was so much fun. He was like the little Jewish kid. The funniest scene I'll ever remember.
Right? Did you know this?
Chaim, yeah. Chaim, he told me the story that when they played the Coventry, his mom came. Here's a story. I'm sitting in Great Neck at my house. He's in New Hyde Park at his mother's apartment, and it's Passover. And I'm sitting there, and I have the telephone number. He's got the phone number of my mom's house. I got the phone number of his. Phone rings. Mitch, it's Gene. Do you want to come over for dessert for Passover?
Going, do you want to find the Afikoman?
I go, okay, so yeah. So I walk in, so we drive over to the house where we go and park the car, go into the front door, and at the head of the table is Gene Simmons with a yarmulke on and a shirt and a vest. To his left is Lisa Hartman and Paul Stanley, because that was the boyfriend and girlfriend then, Howard Marks and people from the office. Diana Ross, her ex-husband, and her kids are now on the TV, on their own TV shows and stuff like that. And we walk in. Hey, come sit down. And I've known them all anyway. So we sit down, and then Florence, the doorbell rings, and it's a girl dressed in an Easter bunny outfit, comes in to sing an Easter song for Jean. She was like multi-denominational there, even though they came from there. But he tells the story that Florence, that wonderful woman who just did that stuff, he at Coventry, he says to me, so we're doing the show, we had the makeup, and afterwards we were doing the meet and greet and talking to the press, and then she comes backstage, and she says, Chaim, you were wonderful. Which one were you? Because he was wearing the makeup. Yes, she had no idea which one was her son.
That's hilarious.
And so when he got the Runaway movie with Tom Selleck, yeah. I'm in the apartment on Fifth Avenue, and he's in sweats. He tells me the movie. He says, wait, I got to do the first line with him. His first line, he's at a street vendor. He goes, supposed to go, he goes, coffee, please. No, no, wait. He's the Jewish boy. He said, please. His line's supposed to be coffee, black. But he says, please. So he's talking about the movie. I'm reading the script and stuff like that. And then the phone rings. And it's his mother. And the conversation's like this. Hi, Mom. Yeah, I'm here with Mitch. Yeah, we're going to do a little writing. Okay. Yes, I got that movie with Tom Selleck. Yes, Magnum P.I. I got the movie with Magnum P.I. Yeah. You can see it at the theater in Flushing, Mom. You can go to the multiplex. See it. No, you can see it in any... Mom, it's a movie. No, it's not. It's not. Mom, it's a movie. It's a major movie. It's in the movie that... Yes, Tom Selleck... Yeah. Mom! That's reducing him to the yes. Jewish boy we all are, unfortunately.
Yeah.
With their moms around.
Nice.
Yeah, but he was always great. He was great. He was great.
So where could I hear your stuff now? How do I find you? How do the listeners
in our living
find
rooms.
You?
There are some demos that are up on YouTube. There are demos on there. One of the funny things is when we used to record, Gene and I was saying, multi-tracking, do everything on the Porter Studio. You bounce it down. Then I would bounce it to mono. Then bounce it back into two tracks. The other two tracks bounce back to mono. Okay. Bounce it. And we're all doing this all out of a four track to a cassette deck that goes on and off like this. We were so good. It sounds like solenoids. It sounds like the demos were rough, but there's like 16 tracks on there. And people say, what'd you record that on a 16 track? No, it's because the last two tracks, all the music bounced to mono, three tracks open and do one voice partly, pan that way, and another one that way, mm-hmm. and one in the middle. And it sounds like stereo, but it's only because of the last two things.
So I'm so sorry. I know you've been talking for a while and I don't want
to
keep you much longer, but... Did Gene want you to be part of the band, or was he just looking for inspiration?
At the time, it was funny because they had been, they've been together for years. So this is 84 or so, and I became like the third wheel, the man in the middle, per se. We would go out sometimes as a trio or sometimes as a just solo with Gene, solo with Paul, like all the time.
So where were the other two, Ace and Peter?
Ace and Peter were somewhere in their own world. By that point, though, it was Eric Carr and...
was that the Fox?
The Fox.
So you would perform?
We just go out and hang out and do stuff. There's some video, there's some still shots of me and Paul playing at somebody's house. Pepe Castro from the Blues Magoos, his house, and there's a shot of Paul playing guitar, me playing two drumsticks as clavés because we're doing All Right Now. There's some pictures which I don't have now because my ex little sister in law has them of me on stage fronting a band. My backing band is Klaus Meine from the Scorpions, Paul Stanley, Michael Bolton. They're my background singers. I'm doing All Right Now, and that's my backing band.
Wow.
So people used to come and sing with me. Then there's that famous shot of me for Bon Jovi singing lead, and I'm playing guitar, and Steve Ferroni and Carmine Rose or the rest of the band, because we were waiting to see the Rolling Stones play. They didn't show up. So we went, okay, let's go play. So I've always been somehow in the middle of these jams and stuff like that.
Me and
Julian Lennon and stuff like that. All the time.
Rock and roll.
Told you.
Yeah, man.
Stuff I've forgotten. But there are demos out there online somewhere.
Well, Mitch, it's been a real pleasure being able to sit and just listen to you, because normally I talk a lot.
Yeah.
As well, these guys know.
That's why you gave me a break. You gave yourself a break.
And actually, he gave us a break.
And I actually... Yeah. Talk slower for the first time.
You think so?
Relative for me. This
yeah. Okay.
Slow.
Good. Well, we heard everything. So, can anyone get in touch with you? Are you available? Are you social media? Are you doing?
I am.
Like
I'm
that?
On. I have two pages on Facebook. One's pretty much a fan page. The other one is the masthead is that picture of me with Michael Jackson.
What is the Mitch Weissman fan page?
Just Mitch Weissman on Facebook. Mm-hmm. There is a fan page too, but Mitch Weissman's way to get a hold of me.
Okay.
Well, we've been trying to talk to Mitch about doing a one man show where he gets on stage and tells these stories and interacts with the audience and sings and stuff, because he's still, I've seen him recently. I saw you at the, what's that German Brauhaus you guys play at?
Oh, Alpine Village.
God, it's so cool out there.
Yeah,
where's that?
I haven't done it anymore. It's in Torrance.
But it looks like a Brauhaus from the 60s and
like German.
Yeah,
Berlin, like it's crazy.
Right now, you can see me. I have two shows coming up at the Kobe Steakhouse in Seal Beach. What we call the breakfast shows, because it is. It's Breakfast with the Beatles, but it's not Chris Carter's show. It's Beatle bands on the other weekends. It's a lot of fun, a lot of champagne, a lot of free flowing stuff, and by the end, everybody's really loose. Not necessarily the band, but I'm playing on the 24th of April and May 8th. Amazing. That I know about, right?
And Facebook is a place where people can just find you and
find me and
see your shows,
message me and stuff like that. Yeah, I'm doing anything I can. You can find me there.
Okay, so Facebook, no Twitter, or no Instagram,
or you can come visit me at Sam Ash on Sunset, 7360 Sunset Boulevard, here, right down the block.
And by the way, I just want to say one last thing in closing.
And people do
is
it's nice, it's, man.
We now Sadie's known Mitch for a couple of years now through me. And he's been to the house and come over and hung out and everything. And, you know, all of we have mutual friends and we hang out in same kind of circles and stuff. You've always been the same very humble, sweet person. And that's, I think, why it's so, when you tell these stories about all the life you've had, it's not hard to imagine. It's just, it doesn't seem normal to me, but I remember still, you know, at 10 years old going backstage at that theater in Chicago and getting your autograph, which I still have on my Beatlemania program. That's in my treasure chest.
What's funny is when they're doing the first Star Trek movie.
You were very kind to us kids.
Mark Leonard, who played Sarek, Spock's father, was downstairs in my neighbor's apartment. And so she says, come on down, we'll meet somebody. I knew he was an actor, but no, he's doing so. But he was doing the first Star Trek movie when total secrecy. And he showed me the Polaroid of the Klingon alpha. And I'm going, like, oh my God, is him in his Klingon makeup? And I'm going, not his Klingon, but the Klingon. He stole them off the set. And he said to me, okay, but I need an autograph.
Wait, who are you talking about?
Mark Leonard played Leonard Nimoy's dad in the first Star Trek movie. And he shows me some stuff. Now I'm going, oh my God, I'm meeting this guy and seeing this stuff. But he says to me, now I need an autograph. I said, you want my autograph? I'm still like that all the time. Like, you want my autograph? I said, yeah, only if you give me yours. So I got a lot of those stories I've forgotten about, really. Just, you know, for a while, I used to play with a band, and we'd go through airports and so-and-so with Pat Riley. All these people. Hi, Mitch. From across the way. Okay. Hi, Pat.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Thanks.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Have a million more questions.
Well, call me back sometime. Yeah. I'll be happy to.
I'm Pistol of Pistol and Dagger. And
Dagger.
I'm And. Or I'm Society. I gotta,
you know, as long as we're here, explain.
He's the glue that holds them all together.
Yeah.
Or keeps them from killing each other.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. That one.
Now, by the way, I know that this is.
By the way, I did just check you out on Facebook, and that picture is amazing. Michael Jackson right there. Yeah. Steven Tyler, right? That is.
Andy Warhol, it's great.
What is it like for you to listen to stories about this kind of music? Because this isn't what you're into more. You're into a different kind of music.
What music do you like?
I love hip hop.
Yeah, I love that stuff.
I mean, so.
Nobody would think so. My girl loves it too.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm actually going to New York next week, which when this airs will be in the past.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go for this design cipher for the Universal Hip Hop Museum.
Oh, it's going to be fantastic.
And they're starting it in the Bronx.
Wow.
And a lot of the founding fathers of hip hop support this.
Yeah.
And, you know, for so long, hip hop has tried, or let's say other places outside of hip hop have tried to define it or award it or recognize it. But hip hop hasn't done that for itself.
Exactly.
And so this is what is coming. So we're going to go to New York and
talk
about how this is going to be designed, what the fans and what the people of the culture.
The input of that will be great. Yeah, it'll be fantastic.
It's going to be amazing. And they're doing it right now, tentatively, and it's not for certain, but pretty certain the Bronx Borough Courthouse will now be turned into the Universal Hip Hop Museum.
That's a great building to do it in.
So,
are you involved in it? Are you part of this?
Yes, I'm actually on the advisory board.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And so I'm very excited about that. But the question was, is how do I feel? I mean, listen, I love great stories. It doesn't need to be hip hop. It could be anything. And obviously, you were right. Mitch has amazing stories. But I love it. I mean, I know, listen, I know the Beatles. I know, you know, Aerosmith. I know Kiss was my first favorite band before I started liking hip hop. So, you know, I was playing with these little paper dolls of Kiss listening to records and making my own concerts before Rapper's Delight ever came out.
Oh my God. It's great.
Yeah. So I love hearing it. It's a total.
I'll have to tell you some hip hop guys stories next time.
give me one quick one.
I'm trying to remember what it was now. Where was I?
Because, I mean, New York was popping.
Was it Flavor Flav?
It was God, no, locking and popping, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Where the heck was I on that? Oh, my brain's gone.
All right, you save that one for me.
I'll Facebook friend me. I'll send it to you.
I already Facebook friended you, man. I hope you accept me.
I will.
All right. Well, this is Adam, and we've got our men and ladies.
Kenny Jack.
Sadie.
This is the Pistol and Dagger Society.
We are...
This is a great society. How often do you meet?
Once a week now.
We've been doing this once a week. It's been fantastic. Really.
Yeah, we wanted to do something that kind of gave us a chance, like us as songwriters, a chance to actually hear songwriters talk, you know, and ask them questions and get a chance to hear some music and some great stories. And
next time we'll bring a guitar or something. I'm not sure.
Please. But we also, you know, it's the passion too. You know, we love hearing this. And I for me personally, I don't know if you guys are feeling this, but it's really nice to hear you talk about those days. Like when you talk about the John Lennon stories and you describe the snow and the Jerry Lewis moment and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Despite all the things that you've been through, ups and downs at the industry, you're at a point now in your life where that stuff's all very fond memories.
Yeah, it's good.
You could even talk about like those manager guys not giving you those deals and there's still a smile on your face.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Any mistakes I made on my own, I've made on my own. I may have been directed a certain way or something, but nobody put a knife, nobody pushed me off the subway platform. And I smile at it because it's like, that's a hell of a lesson. You know, it may have cost me future income. Nothing ever cost me the money I had at the time, except maybe my own mistakes. But, you know, sometimes there's little stories have come up. And so that one producer said to me, you threw me out of the office and didn't take the offer and all that shit like that to make me into a star because it was ego. Mm-hmm. Years later, the China Club in Manhattan, his son wanted to throw a party. And the guy said, who's this Steve Lieber guy? I'm going, give me the phone. Steve, this is their club. This is the deal. Come on, Mitch. You can make it happen. Steve, what are you going to do, fire me? No. This is the deal. This is what it is. Take it or leave it. He took it. Took the deal.
There you go.
But I said, where do you think I learned this from? You.
Right.
So I am fond about it. I've learned a lot of things from all this stuff. You know, at one point, my sister said to me, I don't understand why you're not like very, a lot of things have gone the wrong way. I was still fine. You know, why aren't you suicidal? I said, what good does that do?
Right.
I said, but I will tell you though, the day I die, on the way to either heaven or hell,
right?
That's when you hear me go, you fucking idiot.
Yeah.
You fucking idiot.
And it all comes out. There you go. Well, yeah, I mean, part of this show you were just asking is also what Ken and Sadie were talking about. But, you know, we're at a comic book store.
Yeah.
Meltdown Comics.
Which we never talked about. That was my first love.
Really?
Wally Wood comics.
Oh, boy.
Jim Steranko autographs.
Oh, my
and
God.
And pictures and scribbles on pictures of me. I mean,
his art was ridiculous, Jim Steranko, Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.
and
stuff.
And the Panther, Black Panther.
Oh, my gosh. You know, you excited for Black Panther being in the Marvel Cinematic Universe?
I can't wait to see how they do that.
Okay.
Captain America, it was great. My biggest disappointment as a kid in college, I wrote a heartfelt letter that was like 3 pages long to Marvel, I forgot who the guy was in 73 that was the letters, about pouring my heart out I was a member of the Merry Marvel Marching Society. I still have the membership card somewhere. That's like 45 years ago. And they never wrote back. And that experience there is what made me answer every single fan mail I ever got.
There you go.
And I have chunks of them filled somewhere.
Really?
Snail mail. And then also, that's why I answer all the Facebook requests and stuff like that as well.
There you go.
But thank God for the voice recorder. Yeah. Hi, thanks for stopping by.
Yeah. Well, clearly, you know, comics, I mean, that's a very passionate following and culture, and that's kind of what this show, you know, I think Ken envisioned initially was how can I merge this songwriting with this passion and people's love for passion and, you know, share that. And that's where you melt down and Pistol and Dagger come together.
That's
so
great.
It's a very nice combination. So thanks again for joining.
Thank you, guys. Thanks so much.
All right. So this is the Pistol and Dagger Society presented by Meltdown Comics, produced and engineered by the great Mason Booker.
Woo!
Also, just for all you interested podcast listeners, Meltdown has a number of podcasts, including Anime Attic, which is produced, recorded, featuring. Thank you.
Something like that.
Yeah, something. I'm totally fucked up right now. Mason is the host of that show, and he dusts off old anime and then talks about it with great co-hosts. There's On Some Hip Hop Shit, which is a great Meltdown podcast. There's History of the Batman. Check it all out, meltcomics.com. Come and visit the store, Sunset Boulevard. You can now hit Sam Ash and Meltdown at the same time.
And you're bound to see some people come in with bags from here all the time.
There you go. All right. So thanks for listening. Tune in next week.